The views expressed on this program are the views of the individual broadcaster and do not necessarily reflect the view of Wesleyan University or the WESU management. Hello, and welcome to Reasonably Catholic, Keeping the Faith, a progressive-minded radio show about faith and action, coming to you from Wesleyan University's WESU, 88.1 FM, Middletown, and WESUFM.org, providing community radio that matters. I'm Maria Johnson. Today, a real privilege, a visit with U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro about her new book, The Least Among Us, Waging the Battle for the Vulnerable. Congresswoman DeLauro, who was born and raised in New Haven and has deep Italian-American Catholic roots, has represented Connecticut's 3rd District and the rest of us Americans since 1991. She is a long-standing member of various important committees, and it's her zeal for that work on behalf of the least among us that we'll talk about. She comes by her zeal naturally by virtue of her upbringing. Her parents were public service-minded, and her work is informed by Catholic teaching. Speaking of that, please try to listen to the end of the interview when she'll share a story of some rough treatment at the hands of a former archbishop, causing her to wonder, as do we all progressive-minded Catholics, how the bishops can call themselves pro-life when they are silent about budget cuts that will harm people in the most need. If you miss any of the episode, I'll post it on the Reasonably Catholic website this evening, as well as the schedule of these stops on her book tour. Thursday, the day after tomorrow at 7 p.m., she'll be at the Wesleyan R.J. Julia Bookstore on Main Street in Middletown. Then on Friday, also at 7, at the La Grua Center in Stonington. And on Saturday at 7, at the Barnes & Noble in Waterbury. Back in a moment with Rosa DeLauro.
Many dogs and cats spend endless days indoors staring at the wall, living for the moment when you will come home and tell them you love them, take them out, and make a fuss over them. Dogs and cats need physical exercise and mental stimulation, things to do and think about in order to be healthy and happy. Please set time aside for them and give them a real life and real love. For more information, please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals at 757-622-PETA or helpinganimals.com. That's helpinganimals.com.
Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, what to say? You're my hero. I mean, I can't be even-minded about this.
Thank you.
I finished reading your book last night, and this morning over coffee with hubby, I was sharing with him some of the more astonishing moments. Mm-hmm. I have quite a list.
Okay. Thank you for reading it.
My Lord. It really feels suffused with Catholicism in the best way, in the best way, you know, just the most social justice-minded, urgent way. And even the title is from the Gospels. So was that kind of how you saw it?
Well, I am often asked by the press, as you can well imagine, you know, Congresswoman DeLauro, what motivates you? What is it that takes you in a direction on particular issues, on your stances on various public policy initiatives? What is that driving force? And I always, you know, say that it was because of growing up in an Italian Catholic household.
Right.
That is what was formative. That's from where you know I had the opportunity to derive the values, if you will, that drive how I view issues, how I see what direction I believe we should go in.
You give these touching anecdotes involving especially your parents and how much you are like them because they were part of the fabric of their Worcester Square community and helped people in official positions as alder people, right? And see someone in the supermarket whose kid needs a job and says, your mom says, well, come on over to the house. Well, when? Well, whenever, when you can, you know? I mean, it's that those moments in the book were just so human and beautiful.
You know, my mom passed away about 3 weeks ago.
Oh, yeah. How hard.
At 103.
Bless her heart.
Actually, the funeral was, 2 weeks ago yesterday.
Oh.
And we went to Iovani's funeral home, which is, in the community. I grew up with the Iovani's, my parents, their family and so forth. So young Billy, who was the director, we were chatting.
Yeah.
And he recalled for me, he said to me, your mother went, to my family, my parents, and he said, Billy Jr. needs a job, and we got to get him a job. And so she went up to, which was at the time, the Comprehensive Employment Training Program, CETA program.
Yeah, I remember.
And my mother, he said to me, Rosa, your mother got me my first job.
Oh, my gosh.
Then one of the other people who was at the funeral was the person, Tommy Corso. Tom Corso came over to me, and we were very close friends, and he ran the CETA program.
Oh.
And I was working for the mayor of the city of New Haven at the time. And he came to me, and he said to me, your mother was in and out of my office fighting for jobs for the kids in her community. And that's 2 weeks ago. That's 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
So that was their brand of politics.
Right.
That's what you did. You made it possible for people to succeed, and you let government help to get that done. That's what government was there for.
All right. Now, I don't know if you have your book at your elbow.
I do.
Oh, I wish you would just read that first opening paragraph.
That, to me, says it all.
Amen.
It bears repeating that corporations do not feel free to poison us, sell us spoiled meat, lock our daughters up in ninth-floor sweatshops with no fire escapes, employ our underage sons in coal mines, force us to work 13-hour shifts without overtime or a break, or call in private armies to fire rifles at those who dare strike for higher wages. It's not because corporations experienced a moment of zen and decided to evolve. No, they were forced into greater accountability and social concern by the legitimate actions of a democratic government. In other words, if we depend on goodwill, we are all screwed. Growing up in New Haven, Connecticut, I saw ample evidence all around me of just how vulnerable hardworking people are in the face of corporate indifference. In 1957, when I was barely a teenager, the Franklin Street fire claimed the life of my friend's mother.
Yeah.
15 people died in that fire because they couldn't escape the smoke and flames. A fire escape was blocked. The ladders wouldn't extend to the ground. There had been no fire drills. Doors opened the wrong way, blocking exits. It was a disaster, and it happened down the street from my house. It is impossible to be an eyewitness to events like that and not be touched by the gravity of our responsibility to one another.
I mean, really, does that not say it all?
Well, and you look at what transpires from there, and I go on to talk about the fire safety laws, workplace safety,
right.
And that's a way in which employers fulfill their obligations to employees. That's, what we're looking at in terms of a social safety net.
Yeah. Well, let's fast forward to your election to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you hit the ground running. I don't know. Mm-hmm. You didn't give yourself some time to figure it all out, it seems. You were a firebrand from the moment you stepped on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
And at the risk of accentuating the negative, I need you to tell the story of And I'm just going to give you a little hint, and I bet it'll come right to mind. It's one of the stories I mentioned to my husband over coffee this morning, okay? And it has to do with the total out-of-touch cluelessness of certain of your fellow congresspeople. I'm just going to say it involves the 401k.
Oh, God. It was the most startling revelation to me. I mean that very, 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 very sincerely. So I went to the Agriculture Committee, overseas Food and Drug Administration, all the nutrition programs, etc. The farm bills and nutrition and food stamps, etc. So the fight for food stamps and the issue of hunger, which is recounted in the book, has become just a major passion for me and one of the fights of my lifetime. So this was a 2008 farm bill. And the fact of the matter was, we'll go back to 1996, and when under President Clinton, there was a passage of the welfare reform bill, which I didn't support, by the way. They froze the assets for food stamp beneficiaries in, they froze the benefits in 1996, which meant that there had been no increase in that food stamp benefit from 1996 forward, and here we were in 2008. They also cut back on, and is very stringent on asset requirements. That's pensions and what people could have saved, etc., which then curtailed the number of people who could participate in the food stamp program. And in addition to that, on the floor of the House when that bill came up, there was an amendment that cut back the food stamp program by $20 billion. Mm. So it was a goal of mine in the 2008 Farm Bill, and being in the position on the Ag Subcommittee of Appropriations to impact that. So I was up against both Democrats and Republicans in trying to make the changes, including increasing the benefit level, indexing it to inflation so that as cost of living rose, then we would see the benefits rise. The other piece were the assets that says let's open the door further so that really we can increase the numbers of people who can access food stamps.
Not so, penalize them for having a little bit of savings.
That's right. Not penalize them so that they could put money aside and be safe for their family here. So what we wanted to raise that household asset ceiling, you know, the limit had been $2,000, not been raised in 20 years. So many households who had modest savings were barred from receiving any benefit.
Right.
And we are in a palatial room on the Senate side of the Capitol. So the Senate, the Capitol is beautiful.
Right.
And we're there with beautiful chandeliers and all of this, you know, opulence around us. And we're talking about the asset level. And it was a Democrat. It was a Democrat who said, oh my God, if you change the asset level, these folks can avail themselves of 401k. It was staggering.
And you replied?
Do you know who the beneficiaries are? Who, you know, what are you saying? You have no idea.
That a person on food stamps has a 401k.
Right. How could that be? We're looking at people that, in order to qualify for food stamps, it's the poverty level, it's $24,000. If it's deep poverty, it's $12,000. Their ability to deal with 401k
honestly
is non-existent, which showed a fundamental misunderstanding.
Yeah.
And also when you would say that they could avail, that meant that these are going to be people who were going to abuse the system.
Exactly. And that's what also comes through is the instance you just cited is about a Democrat, a clueless,
right,
clueless
Democrat.
But when you think about the Republican side and their cynical view of human nature, that everyone is trying to work the system, everyone's taking the money and wasting it. I don't know, how do you put yourself in the face of these people every day? And I have to say, you don't pull your punches, bless your heart. Well, you know, you ask an excellent question about Newt Gingrich here. I'm going to quote it. How does a grown man decide that not providing food for school children is the answer to America's problems?
You know, it was on that issue, which was the school lunch program. But when you think about it, which is the point I'm trying to make in the book, Newt Gingrich, you go back to 95, you know, if nothing else, some of the folks on the other side of the aisle are consistent. They wanted to eliminate the school lunch program. They wanted to block grant the food stamp program, and they wanted to turn Medicare into a voucher program. So some of those things are still being discussed today. But that, and the issue with the contract with America, the trying to eliminate the school lunch program was the pivotal moment when the public sentiment began to change.
And that was thanks to you highlighting the school lunch program.
We had such a time, and I think back to that it was a campaign. It was really a campaign.
Right. And you won.
We won.
In the first 100 days.
We won.
Yep.
We won.
You, and I think you say the nickname among the Democrats was the contract on America.
That's right. We did that. Right. And I sold it. God bless Save the Children. They had these wonderful scarves and ties. So I bought a whole bunch of them so that whenever any of us went to the floor, the women had the scarves and the men had the ties on just to reinforce Saving the Children.
And children with paper plates, right, assembled in front of the building.
That's right. And we had between 20 and 30,000 white paper plates. We worked with the school system nationwide. And the kids sent in paper plates saying, don't end my school lunch program. And then we ringed the Capitol with kids talking about not ending the school lunch program.
Yeah, I have to say that as much as you're fighting hard and having a lot of adventures and aggravations, a sense comes through that you are still having fun.
Look, I go back to something that Shirley Chisholm once said when she was asked about how do you implement ideas. Now, keeping in mind that she was the first African-American woman to serve in the House, so that the obstacles that she ran into were substantial. But she was asked about how you move, how do you make progress? And she said, you don't stand on the sidelines, you don't complain, and you don't whimper. You just begin to implement ideas. Mm. And so that's my personality. And, you know, I have to hearken back to my mother. My mother taught me from an early age, never take no for an answer and never give up.
Oh.
And so with that nagging in the back of my head, you take on these fights.
My mother would say, you plant potatoes, you get potatoes.
Right.
This is where you get it.
That's right. So, you know, so that's right. And so, that you know, it is taking it on and winning it. And, you know, part of it is my background, it's my family. But I began as an organizer. I came out of, you know, of the rough and tumble of politics and of campaigns, you know.
And you love it.
I love it. I do love it. I really do. When I went to work for Chris Dodd, I was one of the few, not only just one of the few women, I was one of the few chiefs of staff who had not come from a legislative background.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, you were kind of like, okay, so this is a political person, you know, not someone who is thoughtful in the process of, you know, public policy. And I worked hard for my career to turn that view around, so not just for myself, but for those of us who come out of politics, you know, which I did. And it was a steep learning curve. But for me, it's the coupling of the public policy direction that you want to go in and using the political skills that, you know, I've worked on over the years to make something happen.
just getting back to your parents briefly, I see a little note here on my list about your dad and his filing system, keeping track of people in his constituency.
I have the file box. And it is, and my father had beautiful, beautiful, he printed mostly, you know. My mom was wrote in script, but my dad, in beautiful, legible printing, every name, every address, and, you know, with red or blue, the things that I remember, because I campaigned, I went with both of them. They took me along. I didn't campaign. They took me along.
Yeah.
You know, I was an only child. Mother, if it was my dad, my mother was working. She took me. She was working. She took me with her when she went. And into every single house, you know. And again, as I say in the book, my dad taught me, and my dad never saw me elected to the House. But he said to me, you know, you've got a great, great education. He said, but if you ever want to be in politics, what you do have to do is to understand what people's lives are about. If you don't, he says, you will never, ever succeed. And, you know, like my mom's words, those words ring in my head.
You are listening to an interview with U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro talking about her new policy memoir, The Least Among Us, Waging the Battle for the Vulnerable. And what a battle it's been. You'll hear chapter and verse about how hard she's working on behalf of children, women, and the poor. The Congresswoman's book tour will take her to 3 Connecticut stops this week, all of them at 7 p.m. On Thursday, she's at the Wesleyan R.J. Julia Bookstore on Main Street in Middletown, on Friday at the La Grua Center in Stonington, and on Saturday at the Barnes & Noble in Waterbury. Back in a moment with more from Congresswoman DeLauro.
So, you know, I'm a dog, and I'm kind of new to this family, but I've noticed a trend. My humans do this thing where they go around and get all my toys and hide them in this basket, but it's always the same basket, and it's always the same place, and then they act so surprised when I find them, but I'm like, hello, that's where you put it last time. Humans are the worst at hide-and-go-seek.
A person is the best thing to happen to a shelter pet. Be that person. Adopt. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the ShelterPetProject.org.
Yes, you are. You're going to have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Well, it may be the devil, or it may be the Lord, but you're going to have to serve somebody.
Serve somebody.
Maybe. I guess I'll shift over slightly to Paul Ryan, to whom you dedicate an entire chapter.
Yes,
because, and here he is, a Catholic, and basically the chapter is a question, like, how can this man believe these policies are helpful?
Well, I go back. Look, and let me just say this. I want to go back to the book because first of all, social safety net came under attack with Newt Gingrich, followed by the Tea Party. But now the massive assault is Donald Trump and Paul Ryan.
Right.
Paul Ryan has been trying to shift Medicaid to the states for years and years and years. This health care bill was not a health care bill for him. It was about a way of shifting Medicaid.
Mm.
So,
you mean the Republican version of the ACA?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah.
The repeal and replace.
Right.
What he talks about is he proposed to tackle poverty with what I call recycled Republican proposals, repackaged with a poverty theme. He wants to force everyone who receives benefits from safety net programs to work, even people who are really in no position, mentally or physically, to hold down a job, roll back Pell Grant, cut Head Start, and school nutrition programs. But I say here, Ryan's thinking about poverty. If you can only make receiving government aid onerous enough and humiliating enough, then people will opt out voluntarily and redouble their efforts to avoid hunger, illness, or being laid off. That idea is a slap in the face to the millions who do everything right and still cannot get by. It is a betrayal of a legacy of good government in the United States. And I go on to say a legacy that I have worked to defend for 25 years. It's a vision for America that I want to expand so that all Americans can support one another in difficult times and share in prosperity. But Ryan has, as the chair of the Budget Committee, and now as Speaker, it is the very same set of policy.
Don't these people have loved ones? Don't they know any people who are not wealthy? How completely out of touch can you be? And he's a Catholic. It's embarrassing.
And, right. You know, it's about this sense that a government shouldn't play any kind of a role. You know, the social safety net was crafted by Republicans and Democrats. This wasn't a one-sided effort.
Right.
You know, when you take a look at hunger, it was McGovern Dole. When you look at child tax credits, Orrin Hatch, Gingrich was for a child tax credit, as well as a Chris Dodd or Jay Rockefeller or others. The Trans-Pacific Partnership was Democrats and Republicans coming together. And what I say in the book is that the laws for the social safety net were not written by naive people. The programs acknowledge that progress was making us on the whole richer, more powerful, but it also led to an incredible uncertainty and volatility. The designers of our social and human safety net realized that safeguards against family financial calamity benefited both the unfortunate and those in better circumstances by preserving broad-based stability and confidence in the future. They were crafted by men and women who understood why they were elected to the United States Congress.
When you pass Ryan in the corridors, how's that go for you?
You know, he is cordial. I am cordial. It's very interesting. And on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, he stopped me once. Well, we ran into each other, and he said to me, you know, he said, you are a worthy adversary.
Right.
So, you know,
that's high praise.
Right, high praise. And then when he got to be the speaker and he had to deal with the appropriations process, I've been on the Appropriations Committee for years and years. And so he said to me, my God, the appropriations process. I said, you know, welcome to the NFL. It's very tough. And then the final thing with regard to Paul is we were at the White House picnic several years ago. And my granddaughter, who was 12 years old, my granddaughter Rigby, she was writing a paper on the District of Columbia and not having the vote, and they pay taxes and all of that. So she first and I arranged for her to go to meet with. So that night we went to the picnic, and she said to me, Bubby, can I talk to the speaker? You know, so I went to Paul and I said to him, would you mind talking to my 12-year-old granddaughter about D.C. and, you know, representation? And he had a conversation with her. It was very pleasant,
him.
Very cordial.
Good.
And terrific. And she was writing down her notes, you know. So, yes. But we fundamentally disagree on what the role of government is and what role government plays in people's lives to help to create opportunity for them. And underlying that is what I try to stress in the book, is that the moral responsibility of what the social safety net is all about. It's not just a collection of programs. The social safety net is a reflection of the values of this country in helping people and protecting people in times of need.
Beautiful. We've been talking about your opponents. Let's shift gears to the people who are on your side, who you say, quote, are just as annoying as opponents. And the two instances that I'm thinking of are when Michelle Obama pressed you to change your mind about something, and also your own husband on the subject of NAFTA.
Well, as I say in the book, the NAFTA agreement, you know, this is such a reflection of my family, you know. My dad did the research for a Yale professor on the closing of the shutdown of the Candy Rubber Company, which employed, you know, 1,000 people in Worcester Square. And when it shut down, The research that he did was to follow those families as to what happened in their lives. And their lives were forever changed. If somebody got another job, it was, half what they were making, two-thirds of what they made. Their economic security was forever changed. So, I didn't learn that by going to the Congress. I learned that from my father, who said, that companies, when they are, successful, they, their workers are fine, but the slightest bit of a turn down, and the people who are expendable are the workers, and they get let go. And that was, for me, what was going to happen with NAFTA. The cry then, and it proved to be true, there were going to be a severe loss of jobs, a lowering of our quality of life and our economic standard for people here as well as for the people in Mexico, all of which has come through. So I took on that battle pretty immediately after I was elected, worked with people like David Bonnier and Dick Gephardt at the time. And at the time, Stan was doing work for, he was doing the polling for Bill Clinton, and that Bill Clinton was a strong supporter of the NAFTA agreement and signed it, etc. But interestingly enough, I had signed on to a letter along with Marcy Kaptur and a bunch of other Democrats, which was handed to the then candidate Clinton, that told us, he should be opposed to NAFTA. And when Stan introduced me to Bill Clinton, I said hello, and he Clinton said to me, he says, "I see you signed on to the NAFTA letter." I said, "Yeah, I'm opposed to NAFTA." So then Stan and I we couldn't go out, we couldn't go out to dinner. I tell the story in the book about Anna Greenberg, who was out to dinner at night at an Indian restaurant right by the White House. And we got into such a fight about NAFTA. She says, "I'm leaving. I don't want to be a part of this conversation." I want to just say in Stan's defense, what he is looking at today and is working hard on with folks is all these years after NAFTA, what has happened in terms of jobs, et cetera, and what happened with people whose jobs were outsourced, to Mexico and elsewhere. But that's why I say in the acknowledgement, I was opposed, he was for it, and I was right.
And as for Michelle Obama, that phone call?
Right, yes. And look, I such high regard and respect for both President Obama and for Michelle Obama. But I also have spent a long time in the Congress, and as I said to you, the issue of food stamps became really one of the passions of my life and my career.
In fact, you say you cried on the way back to your office.
I did. That day, after that meeting that we just spoke about, I was with two staff people, and I just started to cry. And I said, "We're going to lose this." I said, "We can't lose it. We can't lose this. This is a moment, and we didn't. We turned it around. We really turned it around. It was a tremendous victory with regard to food stamps out of the 2008 Farm Bill. And that became a benchmark for moving forward with what we've been able to do. And now it's under threat again. I think we're talking about, Ryan's talking about $116 billion cut to the food stamp program. So
what was Michelle Obama?
So now, you see, there was the Child Nutrition Bill, which strong supporter of. I helped to draft this, helped work on it, along with people like George Miller and others. And the question was about, the funding of it. And I kept saying, when the White House then was wanting to take the money from what we had put into the economic recovery program for food stamps, and they had taken money prior for an education issue, and they said that they would replace that money, but it never happened. So once again, they were going to try, in my view, was to raid the money from food stamps for the child nutrition program. And that was fine. I mean, I'm not fine to take the money, but the child nutrition program was something I was very strongly supportive of,
right,
and worked on. My view was, let's try to find any other alternative to taking the food stamp dollars. Myself and others looked for places where we might be able to get money from the budget so that could, you know, that could fund the nutrition program. And all of that was rejected by the White House.
Yeah.
I talked to their staff people 100 times, given them several opportunities, several places that look here, look here, look here, where you can take the money from instead of taking it for food stamps. And then the one thing she said, you know, my view is, don't throw your last best offer on the table first.
The art of the deal.
The art of the deal and negotiating. You don't do that. I said, I am going to fight until the end. I said, if we can't get there, then I will move. I said this to her. I'm not going to give up on trying to find another source of funding.
How did it end, this conversation?
Well, you know, it ended cordially, but I know she was, I know she was not happy.
Yeah.
But, you know, she had her job as the First Lady. I had my job,
right,
as a member of Congress, and a great respect for, and, as I say, we ultimately had to do that, was,
yeah,
to take the food stamp money because they wouldn't accept anything else.
Yeah.
And I stood on the stage with the president, and with Michelle Obama, with George Miller, Tom Vilsack, and others, when they signed the Healthy Child Nutrition Bill.
Right.
I wasn't opposed to that. I,
yeah,
was for it, but I wanted another source of funding. And I understood what was at stake, and I was not, wanted to jeopardize that legislation, but I wanted to find another route out if we could.
You know, when I see polls about how much people hate Congress, I think they can't be talking about Rosa DeLauro, though. You know what I'm saying?
Some do.
This is an interview with U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro talking about her new book, The Least Among Us, Waging the Battle for the Vulnerable. She pulls no punches. If you want to hear her live and in person, she'll be in Middletown, Stonington, and Waterbury this week. I'll post the schedule of her book tour stops on the ReasonablyCatholic.com website, along with a link to today's chat. Back in a moment with more from Representative DeLauro.
This is Alec Baldwin. There are lots of ways to show you have style. Wearing fur isn't one of them. Each year, millions of animals are drowned or beaten to death in the wild, or gassed or electrocuted in captivity for their coats. Cruelty is one fashion statement we can do without. Please help the animals by joining People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
To find out how you can help, visit furisdead.com or call 757-622-PETA.
Some men are born liberties, doing what they please, richer than the bees are in honey. Never growing old, never feeling cold, pulling pots of gold from thin air. The best in every town, best in shaking down, best in making mountains of money. They can't take it with them, but what do they care? They get the center of the meat, cushions on the seat, house on the street where it's sunny. Summer's at the sea, which is warm and free, all of this and we get the rest. But who is the land for the sun and the sand for? You guessed, it's all for the best.
I want to switch gears to the bishops. And I have to say, I'm personally invested in what I'm about to ask you. Because I read something in your book that really astonished me and made me almost ill, which was about the day that you and some of your fellow legislators were called into a meeting by Connecticut's bishops, and you batted around abortion. Then at the end, Archbishop Mansell asked you to stay behind, and what he said was so chilling. I can't. I'm going to let you say it.
Okay. Well, first of all, again, you asked earlier about religion, you know, and I say in the book, the religion that has influenced me throughout my life has a lot to do with my parents' faith tradition. They were Catholics for whom faith and hospitality went hand in hand. Faith was a daily practice. It meant knowing what was going on with the families around you and knowing how to help them. Faith demanded services to one's neighbors. So that's that view of growing up in an Italian Catholic household. Now, I was stunned when the Archbishop, asked me, first of all, he wanted to see me, privately, and, was, happy to, to do that. But then he said to me, about receiving the sacraments, which I do. But then he said to me, you are married to someone Jewish, is that right? I said, right. I said, I've been married, and at that time, we're now married for 39 years of this year. So I knew where he was going. He wanted me not to be receiving the Eucharist.
Partly because he noted that your Jewish husband had been divorced.
Right, my Jewish husband had been divorced. I have not been divorced.
And he wants to know how you have the nerve to accept the Eucharist at Mass.
That's right. That's right. And I actually first said to him, please do not go down that road.
Right.
I said, because, one, you are not going to keep me out of my church. I'm not going to do that. It's just much too important for me. God. I asked him, I said, where are you when I fight, for food stamps? Where are you when we fight for health care? Where are you when we are fighting, I said, you can't just pick and choose what are life issues. Those that are, that you believe are. I said, it's an array of, and this was a real, I never thought in going to the Congress that I would, that my faith would be challenged. And that's what began to happen, where those of us who were Catholic, and pretty much it was just Democrats who were being challenged.
Right.
When Republicans were not voting for nutrition and for health and so forth, nobody was attacking them on whether or not it was pro-life. So, it was up picking and choosing these areas. And I had, in an informal way, along with my colleague, Nick Lamson from Texas, we got to talking about, why we were being pilloried. We were very proud of being Catholic. He did so many events in his district. He every year had his big breakfast to celebrate the Feast of St. Joseph. And we believed that religion had a role to play in government. So we were not part of a group that was on the left that said that religion, fade away. That's not who we were. There was great pride. And it was not just pride. It helped to develop our thinking and our motivations. So that being challenged, it was stunning, and because no one went around talking about being a Catholic or so forth. But then, I determined that we had to take charge. We were being defined as heathens, as people who had no moral responsibility, that we were anti-family, members were being threatened. David Obey of Wisconsin was being threatened with excommunication. Our contributions to social justice were being ignored. We were dangerous to the social fabric. We organized. It was a loosely formed Catholic members who were both pro-life and pro-choice,
yeah,
who got together, that laid out our, you know, our fundamental, you know, principles of why we were Catholic legislators, and what we were about, you know, and that was important. It turned out to be an important battle for us,
yes,
to have, and not letting others define who we are. You know, we said, had the bishops acted against the members who voted for the use of force in Iraq? They had not. Why did the church's commitment to life not prompt them to be more activist on other issues like war or the death penalty?
Yeah.
You know, why were Catholic legislators who were indifferent to the poor not being barred from communion breakfast like those of us who were?
Thank you.
You know, and that's the kind of conversation I wound up with the Archbishop. And as I said, I know he was not happy with the conversation, and I was angry about
it. Well, you know what? And I have to say, this is why I say it's kind of important to me, and we only have a minute left. I don't want to take it up with me, but that conversation with the Archbishop happened, from my reading in your book, in February of 2012. And you and I talked later that year, I think it was November, for the show, and I think I gave you many opportunities to complain about the bishops, but you were very politic. Had you kind of gotten over it, or were you deciding?
Well, it's time to tell the story. And I would just say that what hurt me, really hurt, we were on the cusp of passing legislation that could change the lives and save lives of the American people. My church had been always on the forefront of equality and social justice, and concerned about the lives of the American people. And at that moment, in those final days, it was my church who was turning its back through misinformation.
Yeah.
Misinformation that they were spreading, and fear, telling members of our caucus who were pro-life that if they voted for the Affordable Care Act, they would be denounced and decried from the pulpit.
Perhaps excommunicated.
Or perhaps excommunicated is what Bishop Burke said to my dear friend David Obey.
Yeah.
He was in danger of excommunication. Not right.
Not right.
And the story needed to be told that that's where we were,
yeah,
in the final days of the Affordable Care.
Well, we are in the final minute of our chat, and yet I'm so greedy. I want to get this on the air, of course, in time for people to know about your appearances, promoting the book, especially here in Middletown at the R.J. Julia Wesleyan Bookstore on Thursday. But please, may I ask us to talk again so that we can go through more of the items on my list?
Sure.
Bless you, because, you know,
sure,
we haven't even mentioned the president.
No.
God help us.
Mm-hmm. God help us is right.
Oh my God. All right.
But God help us. But look, let me just say this. God and the American people, think about it. Think about it. And I think about it in terms of the book and the social safety net.
Right.
The first House vote on repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. Paul Ryan made the trip to the White House saying, we don't have the votes for the bill. I have to pull it. Democrats, Republicans said no. This was bad for the American people. First Senate vote, John McCain votes no. Second Senate vote, McCain, Rand Paul, Susan Collins, Ted Cruz, etc., say no. Why? Two pieces. Not members of Congress who turned this around. When rhetoric turned to reality about the Affordable Care Act,
yeah,
the American people stood up and said, no, We don't want you to repeal it. It has its serious problems, and those need to get fixed, but you are not going to take away health care. Second piece, think about the social safety net. Medicare, Medicaid. Medicaid became the rallying cry for Republicans primarily. Think it. You got a Republican president, Republican House, Republican Senate. It was Republican members in the House and in the Senate who said Medicaid, which takes care of seniors and nursing homes and their health care and their families' economic viability. Because if there is no Medicaid and no nursing home coverage, what happens to loved ones? What happens to older Americans? You go to the children who are disabled are main recipients of Medicaid funds to help their parents take care of them because they can't afford to do it. I was with a parent who said to me, Rosa, I co-parented for my son with Medicaid. Wow. Without it, he would not have survived. The other piece of Medicaid was around this opioid crisis. Mm. People are using Medicaid to deal with treatment for opioid addiction, a national emergency in this country. So that Medicaid, where in the past has, like I said, Paul Ryan has wanted to do it in, to shift it to the states, became a rallying cry and a anchor in the social safety net of this country. We can win. We can win against Donald Trump. We can win.
From your mouth to God's ears. All right. We're going to make a date. I'm going to talk to your arranger, Sam.
Okay.
We're going to make a date for another long, please, talk about other aspects of the book. It's a very rich read, and there's so much to unpack. I have to know before I let you go, though. As a daughter of Worcester Square, mm-hmm. for you, is mm-hmm. it Pepe's or Sally's?
Now, that question I am not answering on record. I will not do that. I won't do that.
See, are you a politician or not? Wow.
Not right, right. But if you can see strange throughout the book of where we mostly go.
That's true. You're right. Okay. I'll see you there.
I'll just visit. My mom played baseball with Sal Consiglio at Sally. So.
Right?
There we go. All right.
Thank you, Congresswoman DeLauro.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks very, very much. Enjoy the conversation.
Me too.
Thank you.
We'll
Take
talk
care.
Again. Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That was an interview with Democratic U.S. Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro about her new book, The Least Among Us, Waging the Battle for the Vulnerable. We packed a lot into our hour, but there's still so much to talk about, and she does promise to come back. Meanwhile, you can find the Congresswoman along her book tour this week, the R.J. Julia Bookstore in Middletown on Thursday, the La Grua Center in Stonington on Friday, and the Barnes & Noble in Waterbury on Saturday. All of these events are at 7 p.m. I'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode, an interview with my doppelganger, Catholic author and blogger, Maria Johnson. Till then, I'm the other Maria Johnson. Thanks for listening. Now stay tuned for The Jive at 5, followed by Spilled Milk with Charlotte and Acoustic Blender with Bill Revel.